VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty. President Donald Trump is warning Syria's President Bashar al-Assad, Iran, and Russia not to recklessly attack rebel-held Idlib province. He said hundreds of thousands could be killed. In a tweet, the president said the Iranians and Russians would be making a grave humanitarian mistake in what he called this potential human tragedy. The U.S. has also warned Washington would respond to any chemical attack. Trinity University historian David Lesh doubts that will have any effect on the planned assault.
Well, I think he's checking all the boxes and making sure he's showing his opprobrium before the fact, because, frankly speaking, I don't think there's anything the United States can do about it. I think Russia and the Syrian government and their allies are dead set on taking over Idlib, either in a phased way or an all-out massive invasion.
The province of some 3 million people and surrounding areas represents the last major rebel enclave in Syria. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif, speaking Monday in Damascus, said the job of rebuilding Syria is imminent. He said the leaders of Iran, Turkey, and Russia will meet in Tehran Friday to discuss that and dealing with the terrorist threat in Idlib. Chinese President Xi Jinping, hosting more than 50 African heads of state Monday, pledged $60 billion in new funding with no strings attached. Speaking through an interpreter, he denied his government is engaged in debt-trap diplomacy.
Government debt from China's interest-free loans due by the end of 2018 will be written off for indebted poor African countries, as well as for developing nations in the continent's interior and small island nations.
The Chinese leader told African leaders in Beijing China's cooperation is targeted at major bottlenecks to development, and financing is not intended for what he called vanity projects. This is VOA News. Japan is being lashed Tuesday by Typhoon Jebi, described as the worst storm in a quarter century, packing winds in excess of 200 kilometers per hour, with evacuations urged and landslides and floods forecast. A judge in Myanmar, also known as Burma Monday, found two Reuters journalists guilty of breaching a law on state secrets and sentenced each to 7 years in prison. The verdict drew international condemnation, especially in light of criticism over Myanmar's crackdown on Rohingya Muslims. Stephen Adler is Reuters president and editor-in-chief.
We're really disappointed with the result. We're not surprised in the sense that they shouldn't have been arrested, they shouldn't have been indicted, they shouldn't have been convicted, and they certainly shouldn't have been sentenced to 7 years. There was absolutely no evidence against them.
The two journalists were investigating the killings of Rohingya villagers by security forces at the time of their arrest. The verdict from the Myanmar court came the same day that new UN rights chief and former Chilean president Michelle Bachelet took up her new post.
I just couldn't avoid saying something on the situation that I was shocked to today in the morning when I woke up and I learned that these two journalists from Reuters have been imposed a sentence of 7 years of jail.
She called for their immediate release. In Yemen, the government Monday attempted to defuse protests over economic conditions, announcing a rise in public sector salaries. Those protests are spreading. Meanwhile, Houthi rebels called for an International Criminal Court investigation for alleged war crimes following a Saudi coalition airstrike last month that killed dozens of civilians. The rebel movement's Minister of Legal Affairs, Abdul Rahman al-Mukhtar, accused the coalition of targeting a bus full of students in the northwest. He said the coalition leadership bears criminal responsibility. A coalition spokesman Monday said the airstrike had a legitimate target, and there was an error in timing. Israeli soldiers Monday shot and killed a knife-wielding Palestinian approaching a military checkpoint near Hebron, close to a Jewish settlement in the West Bank. Eight people were killed Monday in an explosion at a munitions factory near the South African city of Cape Town. An investigation is underway as to the cause of that blast. In Nigeria, the death toll from an assault by suspected Boko Haram or Islamic State militants on a military base in northern Borno State has risen to nearly 50. Meanwhile, at an international donors conference in Berlin, more than $2.5 billion was pledged to help countries around the drought-plagued Lake Chad region dealing with insurgency. In Iran's currency, the rial hit a record low Monday on the unofficial market at a high of 128,000 to the dollar. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, September 4th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Is the Nigerian government in denial of the continued potency of Boko Haram?
Well, they've done in the past that they launched sporadic attacks on Kano City, and almost 400 people were killed. There were bomb blasts in more than 20 locations. That no longer happens.
Femi Adesina is the special advisor on media and publicity to President Muhammadu Buhari. Malawi's vice president makes more campaign promises, but can he deliver on all of them? Analysts say recent visits of German Chancellor and British Prime Minister to Africa may present opportunities, but China still dominates. And a proposed 16% fuel tax hike sparks protest in Kenya.
As you can see, there is no traffic because most Kenyans left the vehicles at home. When fuel prices increase, cost of living goes up.
One of the operators of Kenya's public service vehicles, South Sudan parties, begin discussion on a permanent ceasefire and transitional security. And hip-hop artists discuss environmentally friendly concerts. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Is Nigeria's government in denial of the potency of Boko Haram? Speaking to Nigerians in China over the weekend, President Muhammadu Buhari said no part of Nigeria was under the control of the militant group. Mr. Buhari, attending the China-Africa summit in Beijing, said Nigerian security forces deployed in the northeast of the country should be credited for degrading Boko Haram. Buhari campaigned on a promise to defeat Boko Haram. He spoke on the heels of reports that Boko Haram militants killed about 48 Nigerian soldiers last Thursday in Borno State. Femi Adesina is the special advisor on media and publicity to President Buhari. He says while it is true the militants might have carried out an attack, the army has refuted their claim of fatalities.
Well, you know, the president has an overview of the security situation of his country. He gets security reports from many agencies, in this case, particularly the army or the armed forces, fighting that insurgency. So they will have credible information for him.
But this is coming on. He made a comment on Sunday. Today we get reports that Boko Haram killed 30 soldiers, allegedly. How is that possible?
Yeah, that information has been reported. There's a report out that, yes, there was an attack, no 30 soldiers were killed.
If Boko Haram no longer controls any part of Nigeria, how come they can launch an attack?
They are sporadic attacks. This one you are talking about is on the border between Nigeria and, I think it's the Nigerian Republic. And being in a border area, you know what can happen. They will strike. They will cross over into another country. So it's not as if they control the territory.
So, Mr. Adesina, is this Boko Haram situation, would it become a problem for your government as the elections are coming up next year? Because the promise the government...
I don't think so. I don't think so, because it was such a huge problem by the time this administration came to power in 2016, and it is something that has virtually receded. What you have now are sporadic attacks, not full engagement as we used to have pre-Muhammadu Buhari regime. Before this administration came, it was almost like a pitched battle between Boko Haram and the security agencies. They really took the battle to our security agencies. But in this administration, they got pushed back to the point of being degraded, and they could no longer launch concerted attacks. There was a time in the past that they launched sporadic attacks on Kano City, and almost 400 people were killed in one single night. There were bomb blasts in more than 20 locations. That no longer happens. You just have atavistic sporadic attacks in different locations, cowardly attacks, using young girls who they are probably hypnotized and trapped with bombs. It's not the same thing as what happened in 2016.
Before I let you go, there have been these defections from the ruling party. Does this worry the president coming into 2019?
As there have been defections, there have also been joining. Taliban, high Taliban people have been joining the governing party. So the defections don't pose any cause for worry.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Femi Adesina is the special advisor on media and publicity to President Muhammadu Buhari of Nigeria. He was speaking with me from the capital, Abuja. The Kenyan government is under pressure from its citizens following a proposal to impose a 16% value-added tax on petroleum products. Fuel distributors on Monday refused to collect stocks from fuel depots as public service vehicles operators staged boycotts in some parts of the country. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, Kenyans and their political leaders are blaming Treasury Cabinet Secretary Henry Rotich for poor strategy and that they want him to be impeached.
Double taxation anywhere across the world has been is a negative thing. A
few days after the Treasury Cabinet Secretary Henry Rotich went against the parliamentary amendment bill that saw legislators pushing the 16% value-added tax on petroleum products September 1st, 2020, activist Okiya Omtatah also filed a motion in court to stop the tax that Rotich had already implemented. The move led to a go-slow strike by some public service vehicle operators in Nakuru and Mombasa towns. Kenyans say it might be difficult for most of them to afford basic goods and services.
There are some customers who come and they want to take them somewhere and it becomes expensive and the customers are not understanding. So at the end of the day, there is no profit you get from motorbike services. As you can see, there is no traffic because most Kenyans left the vehicles at home. When fuel prices increase, cost of living goes up.
On the other hand, members of parliament who are against the move say they want President Uhuru Kenyatta not to sign the 16% value-added tax into law. They blame Cabinet Secretary Henry Rotich for the debts Kenya is facing.
We are at the moment on recess, but we have to see a way forward so that we give a solution to these problems that Kenyans are facing.
For the moment, it is important that we defy it for 2 years to help us stop this crisis that we are in. The indication is that probably tomorrow, latest Wednesday, the bill should be at State House. Given the pressure that is building in the country, I'm sure he will see it fit to assent to it immediately.
Some Kenyans are threatening to stage nationwide demonstrations if President Uhuru Kenyatta goes ahead to sign the bill. However, Deputy President William Ruto says the government must have an agreement on where money meant to repay the debt will come from and not on petroleum products, as Kenyans will suffer more.
Kila mmoja wetu anajua lazima tujenge barabara.
Everyone among us understands that we need funds to facilitate developments, but the funds should never be extracted from the poor Kenyans.
Economist Ali Sacho Khan says the economy will be very unbearable for Kenyans and that the government should work to reduce the tax rates.
Fuel is a key ingredient of the entire economy, so we're going to see a ripple effect right through the economy. It's going to make commodities more expensive. Rotich clearly needs the money, so he's going to do everything in his power to make sure he gets it. I personally think that the whole tax and spend policy has run out of road, and we need now to look at how we bring taxes lower and stimulate our economy.
The high cost of living in Kenya today is the result of the government trying to settle its foreign debt. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, September 4th. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time now is 14 minutes past the hour. In Malawi, Vice President Saulos Chilima says if he's elected president in next year's election, he would launch a 40 billion kwacha, about $55 million entrepreneurship fund to encourage employment. He also plans to create 1 million jobs in his first year as president. Chilima resigned from the ruling Democratic People's Party earlier this year after accusing President Peter Mutharika of corruption. Speaking over the weekend at a rally of his newly formed United Transformation Movement Party, Chilima also promised to reduce the size of the presidential motorcade and review unnecessary road closures when the presidential motorcade is passing by. Rafik Haja, executive director of the Institute for Policy Interaction, says he hopes the vice president will succeed on his promises, provided he can stop the corruption gravy train.
What we're seeing in Malawi is an intergenerational conflict where you have the young Turks wanting to break the glass ceiling, and you have the dinosaurs who wish to maintain the status quo. And of course, time is not on the side of the dinosaurs. And what you have is the vice president has split from his party, which fostered him into power, and he's gone off on an independent tangent.
Now, he's making this promise that the elections are coming up in 2019. Can he deliver on this kind of promise?
I think not to take anything away from him, I think the proof of the pudding is in the eating. Many promises have been made in the past with no delivery. You can talk about 40 billion kwacha being set aside for a fund to start business, etc., etc. However, one has to inquire as to how that 40 billion would be attained. I think it is imperative. It can be done. There's no reason why it cannot. But one thing that has to stop is the corruption gravy train, which exceeds $1 billion. So obviously, if that is curtailed, then he would have the funds to set up such an investment.
Corruption is the reason the vice president left the ruling party. What do you think? Do you think he has the political will to do better than even President Mutharika and previous governments in terms of the fight against corruption?
Well, a criticism that is leveled against him is that he was in government all these years and he has failed to curtail corruption from within, and one fails to see how he would curtail corruption from without.
You talk about dinosaurs. I wonder, where does the former president, Joyce Banda, fit? Because, as you know, she is going to be running on the ticket of her party for the 2019 election.
Look, at the moment, it's a wide open field. But Joyce Banda is somehow, she's got a lot of baggage because the Cashgate scandal was unearthed during her tenure. And obviously, there's a lot of reluctance to bring her back into power, considering the poor showing that she displayed during her tenure in office. But I do think that it's early days yet. And I think at the moment, there are four major parties who are competing for the presidency. And that is the MCP, is the Malawi Congress Party, which is the oldest party in Malawi that used to rule Malawi with an iron hand for 30 years. You have the DPP, which have been split deeply down the middle by the vice president deciding to defect. You have the UDF, which used to have up to 93 seats and held power in 1994 and in 1999, but led by a very young politician who's also in his mid-30s. So I do think that the next government will be a coalition government.
We do appreciate very much. Thank you again.
Thanks, James.
Rafiq Hajjaj is the Executive Director of the Institute for Policy Interaction. He was speaking with me from Malawi's capital, Lilongwe. Mediators at the IGAD-brokered South Sudan peace talks have started a three-day workshop on a permanent ceasefire and transitional security arrangements in Khartoum. Participants are expected to discuss the implementation of security arrangements during the transitional period. Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
Delegates from the South Sudan government and the various opposition groups at the peace talks in Khartoum have agreed on how to implement security arrangements during the transitional period. The parties have formed three committees to address security arrangements, economic reforms, governance and transitional justice as is stipulated in the River Talaiz 2015 peace agreement. The Committee on Security Arrangements has fixed a timeline for implementing a permanent ceasefire and security arrangements during the pre-transitional and transitional period. Edmond Yakani is a civil society activist who is a member of the Committee for Security Arrangements. He says the parties have agreed on creating an assembling point for various forces, repatriation of refugees, and the training of a unified army.
Things like disengagement, separation, and assembly of forces as a preparation to cease confrontation. And also things like declaring forces, telling the number of the size of forces, geographical locations, so that at least if there are buffer zones to be developed, If there are contentments to develop, you have that particular information.
Yakani says the parties signed the security matrix last night. According to the Chapter 2 of the River Atalais Peace Agreement, the government and the opposition groups are to form a national army composed of the government and all armed opposition. He says Sudan and Uganda will train a unified army made up forces from various warring parties.
The trainings are done in unified way. So it means to bring the forces of all the armed groups, or if I can term them as warring parties, they bring all their military to one training ground. They're all trained with one curriculum. Then if they're trained, then they will be redeployed as a national army.
Yakani says the Committee on Security Arrangements is working on a timeline for repatriation of South Sudanese refugees from neighboring countries and organize for the return of internally displaced persons to their homes in South Sudan. John Luke is a member of a former detainees. Luke is part of the committee looking at the governance, transitional justice and accountability. Luke says his committee has completed most of its tasks.
There are no new provisions. This is just seeing the timelines. When this activity will be carried out, will the law for innocent, the legislation for the establishment of the hybrid court will be enacted, what kind of time frame is there, who is going to do it. This is all that some kind of thing we're doing on that.
The committee working on the issues of number of states and their boundaries is stuck. Some members of the committee say they cannot discuss issues to do with the number of states until the IGAD heads of states make a final decision. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum, Sudan.
In the wake of the recently concluded trips to Africa by British Prime Minister Theresa May and German Chancellor Angela Merkel, analysts are pondering the significance of such visits. Strengthening economic ties was a major focus, but China is already dominating in the region. VOA's Chika Odua spoke with analysts about how African countries should manage their relations with the United Kingdom, Germany, and other countries seeking to gain influence in Africa.
It's one of the videos that went viral during Theresa May's first visit to Africa since becoming the British Prime Minister in 2016. In the video, she's in a crisp fire engine red blazer, swinging her arms side to side as secondary school students in Cape Town, South Africa greet her. But May was not in Africa to engage in dance floor diplomacy. She came with an economic mission to create business ties that might help Britain withstand Brexit. She visited the former British colonies of South Africa, Kenya, and Nigeria, offering access to British markets.
I think that the country is a bit desperate because Brexit isn't working out as they had expected. Brexit is, 7 months away now, and there are so many contentious issues that will need to be resolved.
Chita Nwanze, a senior analyst at the Lagos-based research firm SBM Intelligence, said that even though Britain isn't Nigeria's biggest European economic ally, Abuja should make the most out of the opportunity that May is presenting. In South Africa, she pledged £4 billion to support African markets. May also promised that her country would overtake the United States to become the biggest investor in Africa out of the G7 countries. America's economic role in Africa has dwindled dramatically in the past decade, and China has filled the gap, playing the role of Africa's largest trading partner for the past 9 consecutive years. Britain and Germany are now trying to catch up. Germany declared 2017 a key year for its Africa policy and hosted African presidents in Berlin at a G20 summit to boost private investment. However, to date, Germany only has about 1,000 companies that are active in Africa. In comparison, China has 10,000 firms in Africa and has financed more than 3,000 infrastructure projects on the continent.
China is challenging all the countries, all the European and Western countries, even the United States. China also, they have no historical background or colonialism. We share something about the Third World, China developed itself.
Bakary Sambe, a development and peace studies analyst in Dakar, Senegal, says China is not only a natural partner for Africa, it's also an inspiration. But Nii Akwete, a prominent independent Ghanaian policy analyst based in Washington, D.C., recommends African politicians, businesses, and civil society members to be wary of both the East and the West. Last week, German automaker Volkswagen signed Memorandum of Understanding, MOU agreements, in Ghana and Nigeria, announcing that it would assemble cars in Ghana and make Nigeria an automotive hub. And where does the U.S. fit into all of this? It's far away in the background, contributing military support, but not much else. The Brookings Institution says U.S.-Africa relations will not reach their potential if the executive office fails to provide diplomatic and policy leadership. Chika Odua for VOA News in Kanu, Nigeria.
Leaders of African hip-hop scenes recently attended a conference to learn how to make festivals and concerts in their respective countries more environmentally friendly. The Senegalese representative was Sheikh Sinet, also known as Kite. He discusses with Ricky Shryak the steps the rappers and organizers hope to take for the next concerts.
It's still one of the toughest issues to address in Senegal. Somehow, Afrikulture Ban, who is organizing the 30 years of hip-hop, is trying to be ahead and face issues that will come out in the future because they're there, because they're not getting addressed, because they're getting more and more urgent to deal with. One of our main interests was mainly how to recycle plastic, because that's one of the biggest issues. There is a plastic peril going on right now in Senegal. Whenever there is a Festa de Zash festival every year, after each concert, after each gathering, you've got plastic all over, whether from people drinking, who have been drinking coffee and throwing the cups on the ground, or water in plastic bags.
Are there any new initiatives that you guys will be taking, you know, getting rid of the plastic cups or anything like that?
So the festival this year happened in end of June until the beginning of July. So next year's will depend on when the Ramadan starts and ends, because usually it's around that time, whether May, June or July. It's in those 3 months. So we're getting ready for next year and getting ready also to test new solutions when it comes to plastic. So one of the key things I learned in the Netherlands was that actually festivals were collaborating with people who were trying out new solutions. They didn't come up themselves with solutions, but they look for entrepreneurs. So the solutions are more local. And we will do something next year and try to find a solution to the use of plastic during the festival.
And are any singers or rappers singing about conservation?
Yeah, some rappers do. Some rappers do. But it's not as spread as political subjects or religious subjects or immigration, or because, and it's a reflection of the relationship or how Senegalese people perceive the environmental question. It's not a priority here. I think it's time, and that's what Afrikulture Ban is trying to do, to bring the urgency of such a topic on the table.
Our Sheikh Sinet, a leader of Senegal's hip-hop scene and member of Afrikulture Ban Association, was speaking to Ricky Shryak from Dakar. Briefly, before we leave you, summary of Africa news. The Kenyan government is under pressure from its citizens following a proposal to impose a 16% value-added tax on petroleum products. That is it for this Tuesday, September 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post-editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Butte in Washington wishing you a very good day.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.